It may be alleged that the above is a council of perfection, and that occultists seek knowledge and power for their own sakes and with no higher motive than to manipulate their environment for their own benefit rather than to transcend it. This is undeniably true of many students of the occult arts, but a profession cannot justly be judged by its black sheep. Let us rather consider what occultism is in the hands of its worthiest exponents. The aim of occult initiations, rightly understood, is to lead the mind by a graded way to clearer and clearer apprehensions of spiritual truth as fast as consciousness becomes fitted to realize them. It is impossible to take the average man direct from his ordinary state of mind into the higher kinds of prayer and mystical consciousness, but it is quite feasible to lead him step by step through successive interpretations of a symbol system to such an understanding and realization. This is what an occult initiation should aim to do. And it falls short of achievement if it stops at any intermediary stage on the path and declares that here is the ultimate enunciation of the truth, for truth can never be enunciated at all in its ultimate form, as is well known to all mystics. In the end, the occult path must terminate at the mystic goal. It has no end of itself, but as the mystic's way is steep and direct, so is the occultist's by contrast circuitous, but nevertheless, being circuitous, it is graded to a gentler incline. And indeed it is doubtful whether, at the present stage of evolution, it would be either possible or generally justifiable to abandon humanity to its problems and go straight up the hill of vision. After all, the occultist remains in touch with the lower slopes, ascending and descending upon the Jacob's ladder of psychism and bearing his brethren company upon their journey. When all is said and done, however, the choice of the mystic or the occult path depends upon temperament. As the old saying has it, it takes all sorts to make a world, and no doubt a world composed exclusively of either the one or the other would prove unworkable. We cannot therefore undertake to contribute to the long outstanding dispute between the occultist and the mystic except by the suggestion that both have their place in God's scheme. Having said this much in the hope of justifying the occultist in his refusal to leave his nets and immediately follow the mystic way, and tried to show that such a refusal is not mere perversity on his part, wherein, having seen the higher, he deliberately rejects it for the lower, but that his refusal may be grounded in a natural necessity, let us now embark upon an analysis of occultism itself. It falls into three primary divisions. 1. Harmonization with cosmic law by means of right understanding. 2. Adjustment of disharmonies by means of the right use of the power that knowledge gives. 3. Purification of the soul by good works on all planes. All these three things belong admittedly to the plane of the phenomenal universe. There is nothing intrinsically spiritual about any of them, yet nevertheless they are the first three steps of the stair that leads up to the heights of spirit, and it is to be doubted whether those who in any given incarnation essay the immediate way of the mystic have not trodden these three steps in earlier incarnations. Under right understanding is comprised the various aspects of esoteric studies which form the theoretical side of occultism, and without this grounding in the theory and philosophy of the subject, any attempt at its practical application must be a very hit or miss, rule of thumb affair. On the theoretical side, the primary study must be cosmogony. Unless the sphere in which the soul evolves is adequately understood, no start can be made in the great work. Such a study must immediately fall into two further divisions, the study of the noumenal and the study of the phenomenal, or, in other words, the cosmos and the universe. We cannot go further into this division in the present pages, but those who are familiar with the deeper aspects of the subject will realize its significance. This study itself has two aspects, the descriptive and classificatory, and the tracing of the course of evolution. In other words, we must approach the subject from its static and kinetic aspects. We must have a clear bird's eye view of manifestation at the stage to which evolution has brought it at the present moment, and equally we must have a panorama of the course by which it has come and that by which it may be expected to proceed to its final form. Equally, we must have a clear and detailed understanding of the nature of man, and be it noted that the occultist makes no distinction between the soul and the body, regarding them as too impenetrably interwoven for any such distinction to be possible, but studies them both under the generic title of esoteric psychology. This study again divides itself into that of the normal states of consciousness, the pathological states, the psychic states, and the esoteric psychotherapeutics, which is their outcome. From all theoretical studies, practical applications inevitably spring, and from the study of occult cosmogony arise two very important aspects of the occult arts: the system of correspondences and ritual magic. That form of study known as the system of correspondences has, like all else that is occult, been subject to much abuse and misinterpretation. It has been confused with the doctrine of signatures, which is profoundly misleading. The doctrine of signatures declares that there is an analogy between different things if there is a certain superficial resemblance. For instance, infusions of plants with kidney-shaped leaves were considered to be good for diseases of the kidneys. The system of correspondences, rightly understood, is very different from this. It is based on the doctrine that the visible is but the shadow thrown by the invisible, and it endeavors to ascertain what it is that is throwing a specific shadow. In other words, esoteric science holds that matter is built up on a framework of spirit, that spirit emanates matter, not matter spirit. Working upon this hypothesis, it seeks to discover what spiritual factor has emanated the particular material object under consideration. In other words, it seeks to find the relationship that, ex hypothesi, exists between the seen and the unseen. Further, it holds that the roots of many material manifestations can be found in a single spiritual principle, and that therefore these must be interrelated among themselves. Finally, the doctrine of correspondences, philosophically understood, implies that there will be mental and astral states of the said spiritual principle in its descent into matter and mental and astral congeners of its manifestations, and that these are interacting among themselves and profoundly influence the material conditions with which they are allied. A system of correspondences, therefore, consists in the knowledge of the astral, mental, and spiritual affinities of any given object on the material plane. From such knowledge come immediate and practical results, for if the relations and reactions of the subtle planes of the system can be discerned, it will follow that the relations and reactions existing between their physical counterparts will be understood. In the study of correspondences, therefore, is the basis of divination. Divination, in fact, is simply cosmic diagnosis and prognosis. There is nothing more miraculous about it than can be found in the prophecy of a speedy death from consumption after the use of the stethoscope. Data have been rendered available which previously were not available to the unaided senses, and deductions are drawn therefrom in the light of experience. For instance, the prognoses of astrology rest on the known correspondences existing between the planets, which are each associated with the development of certain phases of evolution, and the aspects of the human organism which correspond to those phases. Equally, the divinatory method of the tarot rests upon the deliberately designed correspondences of the tarot cards with the various cosmic and psychic forces and factors. But men are not content merely to understand and foresee, they desire to put their extended knowledge to practical application, and with this end in view, innumerable methods have been worked out whereby, utilizing the principles of correspondences, influences can be brought to bear upon the subtle causative factors in the chain of manifestation. All ritual and all symbolism is designed to produce an artificial set of correspondences with the astral spiritual factor which it is designed to work upon, and, by applying the power of the reinforced will to these symbols, to enable it to act upon their subtler aspects, and thereby modify their causative action. Magic further divides into white and black, despite the bigoted denials that there can be such a thing as good magic. White magic aims at reinforcing and concentrating the process of evolution and redemption, and black magic seeks to employ the same powers to manipulate causation for selfish ends regardless of cosmic law. The difference between the two is the difference between the art of the doctor and the art of the maker of intoxicating drinks and the poisoner. Ritual magic may well be defined as the therapeutics of the subtle planes. True, The use of therapeutics without hygiene is unsound, and the hygiene of the subtle planes is ethics. It therefore follows that the mistake which is made by many occultists is to apply the powerful alterative action of magic without also employing the hygienic measures of ethical righteousness, but, rightly used, the potent medicament of magic can do for both soul and society what no other measures can achieve so speedily or so effectually, for it can break the vicious circle of psychic infection that otherwise would have to be left to the slow processes of time. The difference between magic and meditation methods is the difference between drugs and diet. Medicines will do swiftly what diet can only effect slowly, and in critical cases there is no time to wait for the slow processes of dietetics, so it must be either medicines or nothing. Nevertheless, drugs are no substitute for right diet and wholesome regime, and although magic enables a speedy and potent result to be attained, it is only by means of right understanding and right ethics that the position which has been won can be held. Black magic differs from white magic not so much in the methods it employs as in the source whence its powers are drawn. White magic seeks to reach upwards and draw down power from above. Black magic seeks to reach backwards into an outgrown phase of evolution and release forces which have long since been equilibrated into a static form. It is as if the burning alkali and acid that went to the making of a neutral base were freed once again. In black occultism, a breaking down of organized form into lower types of force takes place, and the two elements employed for this purpose are sex and blood. Into the details of these methods it would not be desirable to enter in these pages. In addition to the utilization of these two physical sources of subtle force, the black magician makes use of the evocation of spirits and pacts therewith. The spirits may be the innocent natural forces of the elements, or nature spirits, which he may elect to use for either idle or evil purposes. They may be those evil imaginings of men's hearts which are the evil spirits of the earth sphere, or they may be drawn from that overplus of unbalanced force emanated during the earlier processes of evolution which form the raw material of those forms of existence which are known to Kabbalists as the Cliffoth. Finally, the black magician avails himself of the powers of certain drugs to produce clairvoyance. This subject need not be pursued here, as I have already dealt with it in detail in the pages of Sane Occultism. Chapter 9, A Ground Plan of Illuminism, Part 3. As a result of his training, the initiate should develop certain definite powers, and if he does not develop them, it should be reckoned that his training has failed of its purpose. I have no patience with the schools of occultism which declare that they are purely ethical and speculative, and that any attempt at a practical application of their teachings is dangerous and wicked. The presumption may not unreasonably be that they are unable to communicate secrets they do not possess. Let us consider what a student has a right to expect as the result of his training, provided he himself has done what was required of him. The practical results of the study of occult science may be divided into two aspects: the art of the seer, or vision, and the art of the magus, or power. The trained occultist ought to be able both to perceive and to act in the invisible worlds. The seership of the fully trained adept includes much more than immediate psychic perception of the subtle aspects of his immediate environment. It includes also the power to range in consciousness through both time and space, to return up the river of time and live once again in scenes that have passed away. In the literature of spiritualistic research there are innumerable records of phantasms of the living. The adept should understand the art of producing this phantasm, or astro-etheric form, and be able to do so at will. From the power of the seer to perceive the unseen comes naturally the possibility of comradeship and cooperation with the dwellers in the unseen. These associations are of two kinds. He may merely meet in passing the denizens of the astral plane, the plane of Maya, or illusion, or he may be able to get into touch with beings of a very much higher type and greater potency. One of the chief advantages of initiation into a fraternity having a long line of tradition behind it lies in the fact that many souls will have entered into their freedom through its discipline and be working on the inner planes, and into their comradeship the newly initiated brother enters. He is therefore in a very different position from the psychic who ventures onto the astral by means of his own unaided psychism. The latter is like a person who comes to live in a great city without any letters of introduction. It will be a long time before he gets to know anyone, and those with whom he scrapes casual acquaintance will not be among the best of its citizens. Of great importance to the occultist are what he calls his contacts. These contacts are not altogether analogous with the controls of the spiritualist, although the idea has much in common. Contacts are not made so much with individual entities as with orders or fraternities. For instance, a contact may be made with the druidical schools of initiation that existed in these islands in prehistoric times, or with one of the magical schools that existed in the Jura in medieval times. The initiate who holds such a contact will not merely be in touch with the souls of those who were members of that school, but with the forces which they concentrated by means of their ritual. Perhaps a further example will help to make this concept still clearer. The devout Catholic does not pray to the saints for their own sakes, but in order that through their intervention he may come into touch with the powers behind the Christian Church, that is to say, with the Christ, and through the Christ, with God. The same principle applies to all occult contacts, though they may not aim at such lofty sources. The contacts which are available for the initiate are of two types: with the elder brethren and with beings or other evolutions. The elder brethren are those who are freed from the wheel of birth and death and continue their evolution on the inner planes, having nothing further to learn from matter. They are usually referred to generically as the masters, but there are many different types and grades among them, from the soul but recently freed from the body and undertaking its first simple tasks, a middle dot as an invisible helper, to the star logoi, the Christs of the rays. For certain of the star lodges are now ruled by the lords of humanity. The beings of another evolution must never be thought of as evil spirits or devils. They are aspiring, even as ourselves, but of a different form of life. We might compare the different evolutions occupying our solar system to the different programs coming through the ether on the wireless. They are all using the ether simultaneously, but we only get the one to which we have tuned our receiving set. Should we, by any chance, get snatches of another program, we are very much annoyed, and declare that there is interference. So it is with our contacts with other evolutions than our own. The accidental reception by our consciousness of their vibrations constitutes psychic interference, but the adept may elect to alter the tuning of his mental receiving set and get the Diva Kingdom. The second aspect of the initiate's work concerns the work of the Magus, or power aspect. It is often called the ceremonial aspect, because certain formulas are used for achieving its aim. These formulas are used in the same way as the craftsman employs tools in order to reinforce his manual skill. The works of magic could theoretically be done by the power of the mind alone, without the use of any ritual form, but in actual practice a craftsman might as well attempt to carve a statue with his bare hands. Man is a tool-using animal, even on the astral plane. Magic may be defined as the use of some form of ceremonial, ranging from the simple mantra or spell to elaborate rituals of which the Mass of the Church and the ceremonies of the Freemason are examples. These are two representative types of magic, whatever their exponents may like to say to the contrary. The Mass is a perfect example of a ritual of evocation, and the Masonic ceremony is what it is designed to be, a ritual of initiation, as is well shown in his very interesting books on the Masonic initiation by W. L. Wilmshurst. The whole idea of ritual magic centers about the contacting of a being on the inner planes who will assist the operation by concentrating a cosmic force of a particular type. If that being is evil, the Mass will be a black Mass or the initiation that of a black lodge, and the result will be the reinforcing of the corresponding aspect in the natures of the participants. If the being invoked is good, the result will be the intensification of his especial virtues in the souls of those who share in the ritual designed to commemorate his life or death. The word of power in any ritual is the name of the being to whom the participants look as the channel of the power they are seeking to contact. In addition to the use of words, signs or symbolic movements are also employed, and these are designed to commemorate the most striking or most typical incident in the life of the master. These signs are further crystallized into symbols, which also represent the crisis of that life. For instance, in the Mass we have the invocation of the sacred name of Jesus, the sign of the cross, made by the devout Christian on breast and brow, and the cross itself, or crucifix, which, when consecrated, is at root talisman. The same principles apply equally to all ceremonial magic, save that different entities are invoked. Whether it is justifiable to do so is a matter of opinion, and the only people who are qualified to express an opinion are those who have had practical experience of ceremonial magic in the hands of competent operators. The general opinion appears to be that the powers thus handled are very high potencies, and that in the event of an accident, they can do serious damage. An accident in a high-powered, swift-moving car is a serious matter, and it is not everyone who is temperamentally suited to drive such a car, but the big advances in motor engineering have come through speed tests where, under carefully chosen conditions, specially trained men have established new speed records. We do not say that the 600 horsepower racing car is a suitable road vehicle, but we do say that it is only through the use of these high-powered cars under special conditions that the necessary knowledge becomes available that shall advance engine design in general. So it is with the works of magic. It is to the average devout man seeking spiritual things what the racing car is to the average motorist, not for him, but the source whence comes the knowledge that is applied in designing the car that he uses with so much pleasure and profit. We come now to the vexed question of trance. One can hardly take up a book of advice to aspirants without encountering the most serious words of warning against going into trance, but there is no attempt to explain what trance is. One of the difficulties with which present-day psychic science in the Western world has to contend is the widespread introduction of Eastern methods and systems of development which are quite unsuitable to European conditions. Experiences based on the use of these methods outside their proper sphere do not necessarily hold good for the use of the traditional methods of Western magic. Of the authors who give such solemn warnings against trance, how many have had any experience of it? £1 they had, they would know at once that there are two types of trance, the negative and the positive. In the negative trance, the consciousness of the operator is put in abeyance, is, as it were, jammed, stopped on a dead center, and another mind operates the nerve endings of the physical vehicle by means of telepathic suggestion to the subconsciousness. Whether that mind is incarnated in a physical vehicle or not, is immaterial, the process is the same. This method is, of course, open to serious abuse in the hands of the ignorant and unscrupulous, and under such circumstances deserves all the hard things that are said about it. But the fact remains that in clean and careful hands it is used without evil results, as the records of the wide range of spiritualistic experiments show. It is useless to deny a range of experience as extensive as that available in spiritualistic literature. Positive trance is quite another matter, and is used extensively by every occultist. For certain astral work and for certain functions on the inner planes, the body is left in a profound psychic sleep which is quite different from ordinary sleep. Even during brief moments of vision, of which most students of the occult sooner or later have some experience, the material surroundings fade from view and one is oblivious of all save the vision. An observer would find during that brief moment that respiration and pulse had altered their rhythm, the eyeballs were fixed and the muscles rigid. If this is not trance, what is? There are a good many shibboleths in occultism which are the result of hearsay, not experience. It is the custom to decry trance, and therefore the people who make use of it are chary of admitting that they do. So, lest they be included in the condemnation, but the fact remains that at times consciousness is withdrawn from the physical plane and the body is of necessity unconscious. To experiment with trance save under proper conditions and experienced guidance is undoubtedly risky. The occultist has to learn to function on the inner planes, so long as he has a physical body they cannot be completely his native element and he also must recognize his limitations, but just as the person who goes in for boating ought to know how to swim in case he falls in, So the person who attempts practical occultism ought to know how to go out of and return to his body for the same reason. Suddenly to find oneself in touch with another form of existence without knowing how to deal with it is an exceedingly unpleasant experience, even if there be no real cause for alarm. Finally, to sum up, the occultist who is going to undertake any serious work in his chosen subject must be perceptive, must be able to be sensitive at will, and must have a working knowledge of ceremonial magic. To say otherwise is to say what is not true, for occult science is very much more than a system of ethics based on a belief in superphysical planes of existence, the masters, and reincarnation. Chapter 10, The Headwaters of Occultism. Where do occultists look for the source of their science? What are its classics, and when was its golden age? People are sometimes surprised that the occultist should take seriously the scientific views of the ancients, concerning himself with humors and all the jargon of alchemy. All such things, it is said, have been outmoded ever since the Renaissance. Why waste time on such exploded superstitions? The reason that the occultist seeks his inspiration in the remote past is because the nearer the source, the purer the stream. The wisdom of the initiates is not so much a body of doctrine that has been built up by experimental research, each worker handing on the fruits of his studies to his successors, as, in large part, a revelation received from sources other than those to which humanity normally has access. This revelation, once received, is developed and applied, but in its essence it is a gift to humanity brought by the elder brethren. It is, firstly, the garnered fruits of previous evolutions, secondly, it is the pioneer work of those who have gone on ahead of evolution, and, thirdly, it is brought down from planes of existence which human consciousness cannot normally contact. Out of these varying elements the body of doctrine called esoteric science has been elaborated and adapted to the needs of different ages and races. All its fundamental principles in the present age have been received as the gifts of the gods, and it is only its practical applications that humanity has had to work out for itself. For a proper understanding of the wisdom tradition we must therefore know something of the means by which this gift of primordial wisdom was brought to mankind. For a force to manifest on the planes of form, it has to be expressed through a form, otherwise there is no manifestation. The Christ within functions when we realize, even momentarily, the perfect love which makes all things one, but for the Christ force to function through the group mind there has to be group realization of its nature, and therefore it is that we have the Christs of the rays, and not one manifestation of an impersonal force for the whole universe and all evolution. Each ray manifests its force in a phase of evolution, and the positive and negative aspects of the rays are the lesser days and nights of Brahma. The secret wisdom tells us that the rays come into action in Tum, like the shining forth of beams from the one light, and of their dawn and dusk the precession of the equinoxes is the cosmic clock. Each ray works out a phase of evolution, and each phase of evolution recapitulates the work of its predecessors before it commences upon its own. In order to expedite this task, the fruits of the previous evolutions are brought to it by certain entities who are known to the secret tradition as the seed bearers. The entities of each life wave, having achieved equilibrium, are stabilized as coordinated systems of reactions. The lords of flame are the forerunners of the devas of the elements. The lords of form range from the rulers of building elementals to the geometrizing consciousnesses who guide Arcturus with his sons, and the lords of mind are behind the laws of biology. The seed bearers who come at the beginning of each life wave are drawn from the evolution immediately preceding, but as the rays represent subcyclic activities which do not recapitulate but rather manifest forth a special aspect, the seed bearers to the rays are drawn from the previous life wave which has a correspondence with the work to be carried out in that particular A phase of evolution. These seed bearers are known to tradition as the culture gods, and it will be noted that each of the ancient races had a tradition of a divine progenitor, a priest emperor who gave it its culture. This priest emperor, being a perfected soul of a previous evolution, is immeasurably superior to the rudimentary consciousnesses to whom he comes, for, having completed his evolution, he is of the plane of God, and intuition, recognizing this, invariably treats him as a divinity because divinity is made manifest in him. He plants in the group soul of the evolving race those archetypal ideas which are faculties. This process is analogous to that whereby the individuality transmits the fruits of its evolution to each successive personality in which it manifests.